Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Dr. Cole Mattson. Dr. Mattson serves as an associate professor of environmental science at Baylor. An environmental toxicologist specializing in the genetic effects of contaminants on wildlife, Dr. Mattson's research was recently featured in the prestigious journal Science. The study examined a breed of fish, the Gulf killifish, which has rapidly adapted to and survived in the heavily polluted waters of the Houston Ship Channel. Mattson identified hybridization with the Atlantic killifish as having provided the necessary genetic tools for survival in this polluted environment. He'll explain how and, more broadly, what that means here on the program today. Dr. Mattson, congratulations. I know it's been a busy summer for you, what with the story appearing in Science. Congratulations and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's dive right in. Your groundbreaking research came out in May. The Gulf killifish. Let's just start there. Why is it such an interesting subject?
Well, I think the subject is beyond the Gulf killifish, and it's really a focus on how are animals adapting and changing in response to the very rapid changes in the environment that we've seen over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And this is everything from pollution to climate change. All of these changes, all the animals in these environments have to adapt to better fit into this new world, the way things are now. And while historically we've had much longer periods of time for animals to adapt, when we've changed things so quickly, there's a lot of concern and questions about different species' ability to adapt very rapidly to this changing environment. And so I think a lot of the interest in our particular project was this focus on how rapid we've seen adaptation in Gulf killifish. I don't think Gulf killifish are unique in the fact that they're needing to adapt very rapidly. We did identify a very unexpected route through which they were able to gain the genetic tools necessary to survive in this environment.
Let's define those time frames a little bit. You talk about rapid change in the environment, 50, 60 years, and I think whether it's the Houston Ship Channel or factories, what have you, we can picture that a little bit. But what is rapid adaptation when you talk about with the animal world, particularly the Gulf killifish?
So, you know, historically when we think about adaptation and evolution and changing how a species functions in the environment, we're generally thinking about thousands or tens of thousands, even millions of years in some cases. However, in this particular case, when I speak about rapid adaptation, we're talking about decades. Mm-hmm. And with the Gulf killifish, we're talking about change over 50, 60, 70 generations, which is an evolutionary time, amazingly rapid.
We can picture the Houston Ship Channel. How rare is it, or how rare is it to see a species be able to thrive in that kind of environment?
Well, I think any heavily altered environment, you're going to have a few species that are able to survive under that new environmental structure. We generally expect to see losses of biodiversity when we have significant change in an environment. So it's not particularly unique to see some species able to survive and even thrive. Because keep in mind, as you lose competition from other species, it makes it easier for the ones that can survive in that environment. There's more food available potentially, so less competition can help if you can survive whatever challenge you're facing. And in this particular context, we're talking about chemical stressors in the environment. What's particularly unique about the Gulf killifish is they're not a transient member of this environment. So there are other fish that come and go out of the Houston Ship Channel. And with this type of contamination or pollution, early life exposure, so right when those embryos are fertilized for the first few days of their life, they're really sensitive to the toxicity of these different types of chemicals. And with Gulf killifish, they breed in these environments. They spend their entire adult life in these environments. And so given that their exposures are lifelong, and in particular during very sensitive developmental stages, it is an impressive feat that they're able to survive in this environment.
So you identify the Gulf killifish as surviving, thriving, worthy of further study. what then?
So with this particular type of project, we didn't start out looking to do a study on Gulf killifish. We were interested in this idea that species might be adapting rapidly. And the Gulf killifish just turns out to have all of the traits that we want to see in a good model species to study. Like I was just saying, they spend their entire life in the same place. Now, a lot of people don't think about the fact that many fish species migrate in and out of these coastal bay waters. And not all the same individuals come back year after year. They spread themselves out. And so how we would refer to this would be high site fidelity. So the fish that we catch in these polluted environments, they have been there their entire life, and you've had multiple generations all in the same place facing the same stressor. So it's not just one individual's lifespan that's been exposed. It's many generations worth of exposure. And so we want species with high site fidelity so that we can see a population that's been through many generations of this stressor. We also want large population sizes, relatively short generation times, and we need a fish that's relatively easy to catch that we can work with in the lab. So some of this is just logistics, making them easier to work with. So there are certain traits that are really valuable, and Gulf killifish kind of fit all of those characteristics. And so that was the species we chose to start with for this. And so we needed a species that was most likely to be able to respond rapidly. It's not that other species won't face the same selective pressure. I think we will just see the responses take a little bit longer.
Visiting with Dr. Cole Mattson, and so to get the Gulf killifish, I know you spent a lot of time in and around the waters of what, Houston Ship Channel, the bayous nearby, Galveston Bay in there, and catching fish. We saw you doing some of that in the aforementioned photo shoot. But once you have them, there in the field, have them back in the lab, what process begins from there?
So, yeah, I don't want to underestimate how difficult it can be to get them from some of our sites.
Sure.
But once we get them, we transport adults back to our aquaculture facility at Baylor. We set up those adults and let them get acclimated to the environment that we have. So in our aquaculture facility, we treat them, make sure they're not bringing in parasites and other things. And then we let them rest for a little while. And mainly we're doing that to let them depurate or get rid of some of the chemicals that they've acquired in their environment before we collected them. And mostly what we're looking at is not the adult fish that we collect from the field. We're actually interested in how their offspring respond to chemical stressors and their offspring's offspring and how they respond. Because we want to know how fish that have never been exposed to chemicals respond to a chemical stressor in the environment. We want to control that exposure. So we spawn the fish in our facility, and then we do a series of experiments to understand how embryos that have never seen the natural environment respond to different types of stressors.
Well, let's talk about what some of those different responses look like. What is it like when a fish that was born from parents in the channel here in Waco, what's that look like?
So one of the most striking endpoints that we look at is actually heart development. Some of the chemical classes that we work with are things like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which we think of as oil products and some of their refining products, but also some other industrial classes of chemicals that all work through a similar genetic mechanism, and they interfere with normal heart development. And so when the heart is starting to form, it doesn't form the nice two chambers that a fish heart is supposed to have. Unlike humans, which have four chambers, fish have two. And those two chambers don't properly form when you have significant chemical exposures during those earliest days of development for fish. Now, what we see with our adapted population, these populations that have come from polluted environments, is even when we expose them, their hearts develop normally. And so what we've been able to determine is that we can expose them in some cases to 1,000 times, so three orders of magnitude higher concentrations of these chemicals before we start to see any impacts on heart development. And so they have a much more resilient heart development. So it's protected from that cardiovascular toxicity that we associate with these chemical exposures. So it's pretty easy for even a student to look through the microscope and look at this beautiful two-chambered beating heart in these fish. And without doing any sophisticated analyses, you can just visually see a big difference between between populations that have never been exposed to high concentrations of chemicals, as opposed to our pollution tolerant species or populations.
We are visiting with Dr. Cole Mattson on Baylor Connections. Dr. Mattson is an associate professor of environmental science at Baylor. Recently had a groundbreaking study that we're discussing released in the journal Science. And Dr. Mattson, of course, that begs the question of why? Why are they so hardy? Why do those who were born in that environment, why have they been able to adapt? And I want to get to that, obviously. But before we do, the process to isolate what matters is pretty painstaking. And what your discipline is environmental science, but you relied on the data sciences to kind of unravel this mystery. So let's unpack that a little bit. So how do you go about isolating what truly matters as you study these fish?
So in this particular project, we were making use of population genomics as a tool to try to identify genetically what's changed in our fish populations. So essentially what we're doing is we're sequencing entire genomes. So think a little over 1 billion nucleotides or DNA code there that you're trying to unravel. So for every individual, you're sequencing about 1 billion nucleotides. And we had a little under 300 individuals in this study. So 300 billion nucleotides that we have to sort out. And what we were trying to understand is among those billion nucleotides, what's different between our adapted population fish and our reference population fish, so the fish that had never been exposed. And so computationally, it's quite challenging when you're trying to identify patterns across 1 billion nucleotides with hundreds of fish, and you're doing every possible comparison. So every fish gets compared against every other fish, and we're doing this across the entire genome. So while the question we're asking is relatively straightforward, the computational power to be able to ask it, where essentially we're trying to understand which regions of the genome have changed the most between those populations. And then we also have to go a step further, is after we find regions of the genome that appear to have been altered in our adapted populations, we have to try to understand which of those might be related to just the natural differences in the environments in which we find them and which ones might be related to the chemical exposures in those environments. So relatively simple question, but computationally quite challenging to deal with the amounts of data that we're working with.
How has the technology advanced? How has technology more broadly advanced in such a way to enable you to do this? Because I know the data sciences certainly have ramifications, not just for your discipline, but really for just about any discipline across campus.
Yeah, so I think there's a number of things that have changed. So the technology, both on the computational side, so just on the computers that we have and their ability to deal with these massive data sets, but also on the lab side, our ability to sequence genomes is changing dramatically, and that's fueling this improvement in data sciences because we're able to sequence full genomes for humans and all these other species. We need computational power to do these kinds of analyses, and so it's really driven a lot of development of new algorithms, new approaches in the data sciences for being able to do this. So it's not just on the data side. It's really going hand in hand with the technological advances on the wet lab side, on the being able to sequence whole genomes relatively inexpensively. We've seen amazing reductions in the costs of sequencing, such that over the last 20 years, we've gone from sequencing a few hundred nucleotides or little pieces of DNA for decoding. Now we're sequencing billions per individual in some cases. And wow. So the scaling is amazing, how fast this is advancing. And what it's doing is it's making it so that we can no longer just be biologists or toxicologists. We either have to pick up the bioinformatics, data science, skill sets. And often case, what that really means is we're building collaborative teams so that you have expertise in the many different areas that you need to be able to go after a question like this, where it's a little bit of environmental science, a little bit of toxicology, a little bit of evolutionary biology, a lot of informatics and data science, a lot of environmental chemistry. And we have to build these teams to be able to go after these big types of questions. And I think the world that we're living in has more and more of these mm-hmm. big questions that require really broad expertise to go after them.
Visiting with Dr. Cole Mattson, and Dr. Mattson, I guess the fruit of that work you put in, whether it's developing that expertise, working with others who can lead you in that direction, has been seen in the results of the study. So we've talked about the fact that obviously these fish born in that environment have found a way to survive. You put in the work, sequencing, resequencing the genomes to find that clue. So what is that clue?
So this story definitely got more and more interesting as we went further into it. So the original quest was to identify regions of the genome that showed evidence of strong selective pressure. And we identified two really important regions that were involved with biotransformation and detoxification of chemicals. The fact that we found those regions of the genome to be pretty important wasn't the big surprise. What was really surprising is when we looked more closely at these two regions, the most important of which is the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, there's actually a large deletion which turned off this particular gene, which again was consistent with what we've seen in some other species. But when we looked at that region of the genome, what was really shocking to us was that region of the genome didn't actually come from our species. It actually came from the Atlantic killifish, which is on the Atlantic coast of the United States. And originally when we discovered that, and that was in collaboration with a group at UC Davis in particular, we were really excited about that. And I was still thinking about old hybridization between these two species. They do come into contact in Florida. I'm thinking maybe this region of the genome has been hanging around and may provide some benefit over time. But when we actually got into the data and were able to look at the timing of when that hybridization occurred, when they were able to capture that portion of the genome from the Atlantic killifish, our dates came back very, very recent. In fact, looks like about 34 generations back, which 50, 60 years ago, there was a hybridization event between Atlantic killifish and Gulf killifish in Galveston Bay, likely in the Houston Ship Channel. And so these genes that they carried with them, two in particular, carried a huge benefit to fish that were exposed to chemicals. And so any fish that had those two genes had a huge selective advantage in the environment. So when you introduce a new species into an environment, oftentimes that process fails unless they bring with them something unique in terms of genetic tools. And in this particular case, they were very successful in this new chemical environment they came into, and those two particular genes swept through the local populations, and within something like 20 years, almost every individual in that population, in those polluted environments, have at least one copy of those genes.
Wow.
So evolutionary rescue through hybridization in this particular case. We think those fish were likely brought in ballast water into the port itself.
Mm-hmm. So as you think about what this could mean for other species beyond the Gulf killifish, what questions or tracks to look down does that lead you to?
So I think one thing that's important to point out is while this process of introduction and hybridization provided evolutionary rescue for the Gulf killifish. In most cases where you have introductions of invasive species, it's generally catastrophically bad rather than protective. So I don't want to suggest that hybridization is going to be something that saves most species. I think it does show us that nature is adaptable. Mm-hmm. Given enough time and the right tools, nature will find a way to get through these challenges. What's changed is how strong and how rapid the selective pressure we're putting on these populations is. And so I think this tells us that there are a lot of ways that species can adapt. Some are much faster than others. But mostly we're trying to understand what are the limitations on that process. Can we get to a point where we can predict how likely a population is to be able to adapt over a short period of time to these rapidly changing environmental conditions that they face today?
We are visiting with Dr. Cole Mattson on Baylor Connections as we head into the final couple of moments on the program. I think you've done a great job explaining what this process looks like, even for maybe people who aren't as scientifically inclined, but those who are know the meaning of the journal Science, and maybe even people outside that know what a big deal that is. What did it mean to you when science selected this? And for those of us maybe outside the field, what is the impact of science among your colleagues and cohorts elsewhere?
I think for us, that's kind of like the Final Four for basketball mm-hmm. fans. It's an honor to have been selected for publication in Science. It certainly would not have been possible without a fantastic collaboration involving Baylor students and collaborators from other universities. I think this is the culmination of many years of work, and it's hard work and a little bit of luck, and we found a really interesting story. It's been an exciting time. It's been great for Baylor, especially with our big push towards R1 status and expanding mm-hmm. research. It's been fun to have this success come about at the same time that we're really ramping up efforts to expand research at Baylor. And I think it illustrates what we're already doing at Baylor and what we're trying to build on.
Well, thank you very much for that. And again, congratulations. And as you look down other streams, that other questions that arise from this, we'll look forward to maybe talking to you again down the line.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Cole Mattson, Associate Professor of Environmental Science, our guest today on Baylor Connections. Reminder, you can hear this and other Connections programs online, baylor.edu/connections. I'm Derek Smith. Thanks for joining us on Baylor Connections.